coming up on Path to Zero.
We've got to build what we can build, which is solar, wind, and storage. And by the way, those do happen to be some of the cheapest things we can build right now.
Welcome to Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. Your host is Tucker Perkins, President and CEO of the Propane Education and Research Council. Now, here's Tucker.
There's no doubt that 2025 was a year of rapid change for energy. As we begin a new year, we wanted to look past the headlines and into what 2026 may really hold for power markets, affordability, and the energy transition. Our guest is Robbie Orvis, Senior Director of Modeling and Analysis at Energy Innovation. Robbie works directly with policymakers in the U.S. and around the world using data and modeling to understand how energy systems actually respond to policy, technology, and market forces. His work is frequently cited by major media outlets, and he's a regular voice helping decision makers on energy policy. Robbie, it's really great to have you on Path to Zero. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Tucker. Thanks for having me on.
So really have so many things I want to talk about, but let's really start with maybe what the data tells you about, first off, what happened in 2025? Where did we make meaningful shifts in the energy transition? Maybe what was a little bit more noise than substance? Anything I want to hear from you about maybe what you learned from the data for this year that we are soon to end?
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot that happened this year. I think globally we saw that renewable energy continues to grow and how much is being deployed every year. Solar and wind are by far the most added new electricity sources around the world. That trend seems to be continuing. This year, when all the data is collected, might just be a little bit of a step change given some of policy changes in China, but we're still seeing dramatic growth in renewables. Same goes for electric vehicles, right? The US is kind of interesting because we're actually in kind of a different lane, so to speak, than much of the rest of the world on how quickly EVs are being adopted. But if we look globally, electric vehicles are surging around the world. And if we bring it back home to the U.S., right, I mean, affordability is the name of the day, and everyone's talking about energy bills and energy prices and why it's going up and what does it mean. So that's something we've been tracking and trying to understand what the heck is going on with electricity prices, especially, but also with things like natural gas prices. Those are kind of the trends. And I think, just one other point is despite a lot of policy change in the US this year, it still looks like it's going to be a banner year for renewable deployment, which I think is probably going to surprise some people. I think if you kind of peel back the onion there, it makes a little bit more sense why that's happening. And it has to do with kind of the different ways of the way the incentives for renewables are structured in the U.S. But, that's good for the grid and certainly good for decarbonizing.
Right. And don't you think a lot of that growth, though, is just because those projects were already in the pipeline, they were already generally financed, and it just takes 2-3 years to work them through the network, right?
Yeah, I mean, a big part of it is, right, so there's been a ton in the pipeline, and so it's a lot of those projects coming to fruition, but also some of the changes to the incentives for new renewable projects, because the rules change starting January 1st, 2026, a lot of developers, especially the really big developers who have really big balance sheets and can afford to do it, they're trying to get their stuff in the ground before the year is over. To make sure that they're able to kind of get as much of that tax credit as possible, because if they delay until next year, there's some uncertainty around, how big the size of the tax credit will be for their new facilities.
One of the things that I don't understand as I read about it, because I certainly follow the data as well, see that build up in solar and wind. but I don't see a corresponding discussion around long duration battery storage. I see a smattering here and there, but do you think that we'll eventually get to a spot where we build solar, we build wind, but with that becomes almost de facto some kind of extended storage?
Yeah, certainly short-term, short-duration storage, like four-hour storage. And you already are seeing roughly half of the solar projects, at least, that are, you know, requesting to connect to the grid are already being paired with storage. So the costs of storage have just dropped so dramatically that developers can see the profit from already coupling solar systems with storage. When it comes to long duration storage, that I think is a little more up in the air. The technology is still much earlier on for long duration storage than kind of your typical lithium ion short-term storage. But there are some really promising technologies that made some good progress last year. So I think maybe 2026 we'll start to see some of those actually get, you know, steel in the ground and start to see how they're performing.
Let's go back and address maybe EVs, and maybe we kind of even break it up into a couple buckets, whether one's about light duty and then heavy duty. But particularly as we think about passenger cars, for sure, China continues to buy, right? But they're introducing weekly, it seems like, very low cost electric vehicles. America certainly kind of come off the cliff after their incentives died. Europe seems to be somewhere in between, continuing to buy but not buying at the same rate. Well, what's going on around the world around EV adoption?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in China, China has invested heavily for years now in growing its EV manufacturing capacity. You don't have to take it from me. Jim Farley at Ford talks all the time about how incredible some of the EVs are in China. That's why he imported one so he could drive it every day in the US and try and understand how the Chinese have made so much progress building low-cost EVs. So in China, this year, I think even last year, electric vehicles made up more than half of the new vehicles, passenger cars sold, right? So it's surging in China. And there's a lot of countries kind of around China, Thailand, Vietnam, Tibet, and others that are also seeing really high rates of EVs, in part because there are EVs coming out of China that are very low cost and they're benefiting just by being geographically nearby. But in a lot of countries around the world, there's surging demand for EVs, right? Another podcast I'm on with a fellow named Ed Crooks from Wood Mackenzie, he told the story about how he had been in Jordan and all of the taxi drivers that he met in Jordan, all they want are these Chinese made electric vehicles because they're well made. They're super cheap to operate. They don't have to deal with, going and filling up at the station. And so he was, sharing that it was kind of remarkable to talk to folks. We don't think about, Jordanian taxi drivers as maybe being early adopters of EVs. EVs are surging in a lot of countries. They're on the way up in Europe in part due, Europe has pretty strong standards. We call them tailpipe emission standards that require an ever increasing share of vehicles sold to be clean. So we're seeing that we're seeing them kind of align with that trajectory, but they're behind some of these other countries. The U.S. is somewhat of a laggard, actually, for a few reasons. One is, it's no surprise to folks that consumer preference in the U.S. is different than other countries. We have a lot more pickup trucks. We have a lot more SUVs. We have a lot more crossovers. And actually, the big three automakers in the U.S., which would be Ford, GM, and Stellantis, they don't even really make sedans anymore, which is kind of shocking if you think about it. They're basically only making crossovers, pickup trucks, and SUVs. So there's a lot less demand. I think it's a little bit of a chicken and egg argument. Why is the demand not there? Is it because of what's being offered? Part of it certainly is just the makeup of the U.S. The U.S. is a lot more a lot less urban than some of the other regions we're talking about. And people need to drive further, and they have a preference for these larger cars. And of course, the U.S. has a 100% tariff on any Chinese vehicles coming in, which is why you don't see any Chinese-made vehicles being sold in the U.S. So the U.S. is kind of actually, I think, a little bit on its own island, maybe Canada with it, because Canada also has the same tariffs in place and a little bit of the same consumer preference profiles. But if you look outside the U.S., you know, we like to talk a lot in energy transitions about these adoption curves, these S curves, where you tend to see in early days, there's slower adoption, and then you kind of have this pretty steady rate, and then the market gets saturated. There's a lot of countries where you can just plot. They're on that S curve. They're on their way towards significant adoption. And the U.S. is just a little bit earlier on that compared to a lot of these other countries.
Yeah. The truth remains that we don't really have these low-cost EVs, which apparently satisfy the driver's demands in China particularly. It's just a question of now with General Motors kind of having a pullback, Ford having a pullback, right. Maybe Stellantis never got there. Doesn't look like they're on the near-term horizon either.
The bigger the car, the heavier the car, the bigger battery you have to put in, right? And the bigger the battery, the heavier the battery. So the markups, the profit margins for the automakers, you know, go down as they have to build these bigger cars. Now you have battery prices coming down to offset some of that. But I think you have this combination of, Tesla has, because they've invested so early, they're, and they have their own supply chains, they're kind of way out ahead of the big three that we like to call them. And the big three have kind of deferred the level of investment that, say, Tesla has in building out these new platforms. And so that's why you see, you know, Ford was just unable to deliver the F-150 Lightning at a cost competitive price point. And they just took a $19 billion write down to kind of terminate that program. So to some part of it is consumer preference in the US, again, like the demand for larger vehicles, and that makes it harder to meet those margins. But, you know, Tesla's done quite well with just the Model S, and the Model Y especially is a very popular car. So, you know, the right investments and the right supply chains have positioned them really well. I think the other big automakers are behind. And to me, the big question is, are they going to, you know, pare down their EV investments in the U.S. and really focus on fossil fuel vehicles, which is what it seems they want to do? Or are they going to use this as an opportunity to realize, like, look, we need to double down and figure this out if we're going to be able to compete globally, right? Because if you look around the world, the U.S. automakers are being pushed out of virtually every market around the world, right? And a lot totally of it's right. coming from Chinese automakers.
Yeah, it's, I'm glad sometimes I'm not in the management group at any of those big three in the U.S. because clearly they have a problem in front of them without a very easy solution. And again, it's even more complicated by the different emission standards. I see Europe, the EU just finally cleaned up their emission standards and left room now for efficient internal combustion engines that just 6 months ago, you know, were due to be sunlight, you know, daylight gone by, what, 2030, I think.
35, I think. Yeah, I mean,
maybe 2035.
The policy uncertainty is a real challenge, right? Even in the U.S., you had this kind of like the three legs of the stool is how I like to talk about it. You had the incentives to sell EVs, right? So if you're a consumer and you want to go buy EVs, we had incentives to go out and buy an EV of up to $7,500. You had the incentives to bring that EV production to the U.S., so automakers transitioning their factories to build EVs, or if they're going to build batteries, they want to build the batteries and the EVs. There were really big incentives to do that. And then you had, critically, you had the standards that underpin that. So if I'm an automaker, if I'm Ford, and I have to decide, am I going to make a $20 billion investment in gasoline cars, or am I going to make a $20 billion investment in building out an EV factory and battery supply chain? Well, I need to know that if I do that investment in the EVs, that there's going to be sufficient demand. So the standards were kind of like a nice backstop to provide some of that investment certainty. And those were, you know, we had national standards. We also had a handful of states adopting very ambitious standards. Well, in the last year, we basically lost 2.5 legs of the stool. We lost the standards. We lost a lot of the federal incentives. Some of them are still there for battery production. And so what are you seeing? Well, you're seeing the automakers respond. They're pulling back on their announced investments. They're saying there's delays to the new models that they're going to introduce, right? It's a very logical, consequence of a changing policy environment. And to your point, even in Europe, they just relaxed the standard this week, on the timeline, right? And so that, if you're, to your point, I'm glad I'm not in the chair having to make those decisions, because it's really hard to figure out where to put all, billions of dollars of capital when you can't be certain about whether the policy is here today, gone tomorrow.
Yeah. Well said. Well, that's a pretty thorough look at 2025. But what gets you excited, or what do you see revealing about maybe what happens in 2026? Anything different?
2026 is going to be really interesting. And so much of our time these days is focused on affordability and electricity demand in the U.S. in particular. One of the biggest markets in the U.S. this week, it's called PJM. Yesterday, they had their auction. They held this auction for capacity, and it hit the top. It hit the cap, right? And despite the fact that it hit the cap, and we're talking tens of billions of dollars of money going out, they only got a little bit of new power plant capacity added, right? And this is coming because there's this incredible growth in demand, or at least announced demand for data centers. So I think there are such a divergent view of opinions on whether or not is all this AI data center growth really going to materialize? Are the data centers just placing bets in every market to see which one hits, and then that's where they'll build? And a lot of people have said, they think a lot of this is kind of a bubble. And so I think next year will be really interesting to see, to test out those different theories. Are we going to see continued increases in the amount of data center load, or is it a bubble, and are we going to see it maybe start to pop, and we'll see actually a contraction in some of those some of those announcements? And that matters. Obviously, it matters for people's bills and affordability. It also matters for emissions because of how the grid is moving right now in anticipation of being able to meet that power demand. So that's a big one. I think also, I know we just talked about EVs, but there's a lot of analysis looking at monthly EV or year over year by month. I think EV sales and sales of vehicles, they're cyclical, but it's very hard to draw insights from one month to the next, right? So, when the EV tax credit was ending, there was a surge in sales for EVs because people wanted to get them. And then the next month it dropped off, right? But I saw so many articles trying to draw insights from that. I think it's quite challenging. So I'm very curious to see next year, the full length of the year, where we land on EVs, because I think that will be a real telling sign of how quickly is this industry actually going to move now that there aren't the tax credits in place and there aren't the standards in place? What's the baseline growth in consumer demand for EVs? Because that will dictate really how quickly the sector decarbonizes in the long run.
When you look at that data, are you mainly looking into North American data, or European data, or Chinese data? How do you differentiate, the just vast differences in adoption of so many technologies? How do you determine how that global trend is moving?
Yeah, well, if we're looking globally, then we'll look at global data, and we might drill down in certain markets, right? So the Chinese market I mentioned for EVs is already more than 50% of sales, right? So if they're truly on this S curve, then we expect to see that, that number should continue to grow. And globally, I think we're seeing the same thing globally. We're clearly, we started slow, and then, 5 years ago, there was basically no EVs being sold globally. And now you look at it and it's enormous. I think it's over 20 million. So that seems too high, but it's a lot. It's clearly on the S curve and growing. So, we look globally, but we also look at specific markets to see, certain indicators. I think some of the more interesting ones are actually where there's not a policy driver, right? So in Europe, we have, there's a requirement effectively that a certain number of cars sold are electric. That doesn't really give you much insight into like how quickly that technology is actually evolving, because it's the policy driving it. But when you look at other markets where there's not, and it's just based on economics, that's really interesting. If you're starting to see trends just based on what things cost and consumers' preference for them, that really gives you an indication of how quickly that technology is moving.
Time for a break. More with Robbie Orvis and our energy forecast for the new year in just a moment.
Zero is a big number. Getting close to a zero emissions future starts with using the broadest mix of clean, low-carbon energy sources. You might be surprised to know that propane produces a lot of energy for thousands of purposes and millions of people with virtually zero particulate matter, zero impact to the ozone, zero toxicity, and zero potential for storage-related contamination. It's low NOx and low CO2 to boot. Path to Zero is sponsored by Propane, energy for everyone. Learn more at propane.com.
Welcome back. We're talking 2026 energy signals with Robbie Orvis from Energy Innovation. The other area I'm very interested in your opinion is a lot of conversation around the rising, well, around affordability in general. Let's start there. Food, energy, water, whatever. But, you know, we narrow that focus down to the electric grid. I see two very differing views, right? The secret to lower electric prices could easily be more data centers, which I'm not in that camp myself, or, you know, that cost of electricity are going to drop soon and maybe precipitously. Do you have any views on, A, what's causing these rising costs of electricity? And then secondly, what stops it? How do we sure get do. Back to an yeah. affordable grid?
Yeah. So I think there are a couple things to consider here. First is that it's important to understand why we need to build power plants. And there's actually two reasons. So we need to build enough so that we have enough energy. So in every hour, we can meet demand, right? But there are parts of the year when demand is higher than others. And so in the Northeast United States, where it's really hot and humid over the summers, people turn on their air conditioners, right? And so you get peak demand, right? And so we build power plants to meet enough energy annually. And if we can save money doing that, great. But we also have to build power plants to meet that peak load. We want to make sure that if everyone cranks up their AC for that 1 hour in the summer, we've got enough power to meet that demand and then a little bit extra so that if anything happens, one of the power plants breaks down, we've got extra on there. So what we're seeing now, the US has had basically flat demand growth, so very little growth in net electricity demand for the last 20 years. We've had some new power come on, we've had some retirements, but it's basically been more or less stable. You now have a couple of things happening. There's a little bit of growth in demand from electrification, think EVs, people buying heat pumps, some industries moving from fossil fuels to electricity. That's maybe half the growth. But now you've got additional growth from all these data centers, right? So you've got, instead of growing at 0.2% per year, we're talking about growing at 2, 3, 4, 5% per year. Well, that means, you know, even if you have enough power plants to supply everyone's total electricity over the year, we no longer have, based on these forecasts, enough when people are cranking their AC in the summer and that data center is running and needs to cool all those processors. There's not enough. So what does that mean? So it means we need to build new capacity. So market operators do things differently, but one thing they do is they offer, they have markets specifically for power, for capacity in those moments. And that's this thing that ran in PJM yesterday. It's capacity market auction. And so what we're seeing around the country is that when the operators look forward, they say, my gosh, we need, you know, X amount of megawatts power to meet demand. And then they try and get offers from different power plant operators. Tell me how much you need to build this power plant, how quickly you can build it. And it's kind of like a market. Like when you go to the farmer's market, if you've run out of items, the person selling it can price more. Well, what we're seeing is that they just can't find enough power plant developers to bring that new supply fast enough to meet this demand. And so the costs to build that stuff are through the roof, right? Because we're basically using it all up. That's part one. Part two is energy, right? So we have different types of power plants around the country. Some are more expensive to run to produce power than others. It's kind of interesting. We have this kind of mixture of different plants that are really expensive to build, but cheap to run. And then we have ones that are pretty cheap to build, but very expensive to run. And the more you use in every hour, you kind of move up that curve. So we're seeing it's more expensive to build stuff, but also we're using more of the stuff that's already built and will be built. And so the energy prices are higher or expected to be higher from using those things. The third piece here is also that we have growing fossil fuel prices. In the US, we've got pretty cheap, generally, natural gas. And usually what happens in different markets is that a natural gas power plant is the thing that is setting the price. It is kind of the last unit that's being dispatched. And so whatever it costs is what everyone gets paid in a lot of markets around the country. Well, if you look at the data now on projected natural gas prices, okay, from the US Energy Information Administration, natural gas prices, they're called futures because they're future projected prices, are expected to rise and to rise significantly. And so that means they've already gone up a little bit. And so what you're seeing is those higher fossil fuel prices start to be baked in here. And so when you put those three things together, of course, coupled with that demand growth, that means that we're already starting to see these increases in energy bills because of what's needed to build new power plants, the fossil fuel prices being higher, running more for energy. And the last piece I should mention too is that, you know, utilities have to invest in the grid to keep it safe and running and functional. And they've, you know, some utilities have fared better than others, but a lot of utilities are recognizing like, wow, we have all this new demand, including these data centers. We need to put some money into the transmission system and the distribution system to make sure that when these data centers come online, they don't break the grid. And that also costs, I mean, you're talking billions of dollars in capital costs to upgrade the grid. And you have all of these factors coming together at once. And that's why you have all these people around the country looking at their bills and saying, my God, my energy bill has gone up 40%, 50%. You know, so that's a little bit of the underlying cause. And I think the question is, what do we do about it, right? That's what everyone's kind of wondering. And I think there's a few things there. So nobody in the US, at least, is building a new coal power plant. It's very, very, very expensive to do that. And you just don't see it. In fact, what you've been seeing and you still see are coal plants that are retiring. The administration has tried to forestall a little bit of that with these emergency orders, but that trend is not really materially going to change because they're so expensive to operate, right? So then you say, well, what else can we build? Well, nuclear is an option, but it takes nuclear plants 7 to 10 years at a minimum to get, you know, permitted, built, and up and running. So we're not going to be able to solve this near-term problem with nuclear that gets started today. What about gas plants? Well, there is a significant amount of gas capacity coming on. The problem is that there's so much global demand for these gas turbines, these gas power plants, that the suppliers like GE and others are saying, you know what, like we can't produce more. If you want a gas turbine and you haven't given us your order already, we're talking 7 to 10 years before we can add more capacity and get you more. So you can't really at this point add more than what's been spoken for. Well, that really leaves solar, wind, and battery storage, which I'll also add are the things that can be built the fastest. You can build a solar, wind, or storage facility within, you know, 12 to 18 months, whereas, you know, gas power plant is maybe 24 months, 36 months, and the others are longer. So this is the other side of the problem, right? We have this inability to bring new capacity on, in part because all of a sudden we have this surge in front of us. And so my view is that the way out, given that incredible growth in demand and the fact we're not going to tell every data center, no thanks, we don't want you, we want you to go somewhere else, is we've got to build what we can build, which is solar, wind, and storage. And by the way, those do happen to be some of the cheapest things we can build right now. And that's what you're seeing. If you look at what the different types of projects are around the country that are trying to get built, it is overwhelmingly solar, wind, and storage. And to our earlier conversation today, a lot of that is solar with batteries or wind with batteries. But it has gotten a lot harder to build those things over the last year in the U.S. The Trump administration has basically put in place a policy that makes it very hard for new projects to get permitted, and adds a lot of uncertainty to that. We've also seen with the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, a termination of incentives for those facilities. And then we've got this giant challenge called permitting reform as a whole bucket of things, which really just means it's really hard for those facilities to get permitted and connected to the grid. And so that's a major problem. So we've got, just to bring it all back, we've got this crazy surge in demand and the need to harden the grid to accommodate that and the need to build new stuff. And then on the supply side, we've got a limit on what we can build because there's so much demand for that. And we've made it much harder to build stuff generally. And when you put that all together, you can see how that can drive up energy prices. And so the way out is to free up the ability to build stuff, to expedite it, to make it cheaper and easier, and to really build like what we can build today, which is really to lean in on wind, solar, and storage. Yes, gas, if you can get it and add it, great. But in order to meet that growing demand, it's got to be what's available today. And that's really wind, solar, and storage.
So that is a really lengthy and thorough, you know, explanation of what's going on in the grid. But the final chapter of that would leave our listeners, I think, somewhat discouraged, because the one thing you didn't talk about at length is also the whole issue of the balancing authorities, the grids, the PJMs, the ISOs, and FERC, that natural tension.
Yes. Yeah.
But what you, if you're a listener and you're thinking about this impact on you, there really is no good short-term solution. I mean, you would think we're going to continue to build in the short term more data centers because they seem to be able to be permitted and built. They're trying, maybe they bring their own power, maybe they use grid. But all those things you talked about are really 7 to 10 year horizons. If in fact some of them even have an horizon, such as land use issues, permitting issues.
Yeah.
I mean, really, really a daunting response to even a more daunting problem, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a couple nearer term things. So you're absolutely right. FERC is an option. And this week, FERC put out, I think actually today, a new rule related to large load interconnections, which means how data centers especially could connect to the grid and the fact that they can bring their own power. So from what I've read so far, and it's still like very early, the general sentiment is that this rule does help add a lot of clarity and allow a little bit more flexibility for data centers that are connecting. So that's one. Two is there is interest on a bipartisan basis in doing something on permitting reform, right? I mean, we've heard it for years. There's a couple of bills in Congress right now. It's not clear to me that Congress will be able to agree on something to get that across the finish line. But if they did, and it was, you know, material and its ability to address these bottlenecks and these connection queues, that could immediately help greenlight a bunch of projects and get a bunch more capacity built. So that, you know, Congress has an opportunity to materially move the needle on the ability to build power plants in the U.S. And that, you know, the time couldn't be better for that than right now, because that's a real problem. But to your point, and I guess one other thing I would add is just data centers have typically said, look, we've got these billions of dollars in investments in our processors. We're in a race with our competitors to figure out who's going to win the AI race. we simply cannot not operate at 100% of our output, throttle down 100% of the time. Well, that narrative is starting to change a little. Why? Because increasingly data centers are trying to connect to the grid and the utility is saying, look, if you're telling me you can't operate a little bit flexibly, I can't connect you. If you are able to tell me that, like, when those air conditioners are running and the grid is strained, that you can dial back a little bit, I can connect you, because then you're freeing up some of the constraint. And we're starting to see some data centers agree to that, at least in theory. And so if data centers can do that and operate a little bit flexibly, we can accommodate more of them and reduce the strain on the grid. So I think there are a few pieces, you know, FERC and backstop siting authority being one, permitting reform, and then also how the grid operators do or don't address their connection queues, and then how data centers are or aren't willing to operate flexibly, all of which could help address this to some degree. But I do think some of it is baked in at this point. I mean, you're not going to be able to fully mitigate it, but that's not to say that these things can't significantly help address some of the rising energy costs.
As you look out a couple years, maybe even out 3, 4, 5 years, does any technology jump up to be a big part of the solution? I mean, maybe you talk about fusion, maybe you talk about demand response that really is managed better. Any technologies out there that you think could really change this conversation?
Well, I think the rise of hybrid solar, in particular, solar plus storage, is really interesting. And I'm curious to see how those plants operate in the market. Are they really able to help, move the power around to when it's most needed? That would certainly, if we got really well operating solar plus storage, that could be a significant contribution. In terms of more novel technologies, I mean, I've got my eye on enhanced geothermal. Just this week, there was a company, I believe it's called Ever, EAVOR, and they announced their first commercial scale enhanced geothermal plant. And there's a company, Fervo, in the US that's been doing that as well. So I don't know about 5 years, but if they're able to show that they're able to scale and hit some of their cost targets, then that's actually quite promising. And they're a lot less geographically constrained than traditional geothermal. And I think you brought it up early on, but long duration energy storage, you know, what's going on with long duration energy storage? If we get that solved at a cost that's reasonable, that really changes how we can manage the grid. And what, you know, you could imagine, for example, you know, when demand is way down in the winter, you load up the long duration energy storage, and then in summer you have that to call upon, right? And then you get around some of these issues with having to grow the grid significantly. So, I don't know, maybe there'll be a breakthrough next year. I'm not sure. I don't want to discount things like fusion and SMRs, small modular reactors. I just, I want to see them, as with these other technologies, I want to see them in action first before I'm willing to say, okay, this is the thing. If we had a breakthrough in SMRs next year where they were, you know, modular and able to be factory produced at scale and cost, that would be an enormous breakthrough. And we could deploy these all over. I'm not sure we're there yet.
Again, kind of a 10-year out solution, probably.
Yeah.
To your point, even enhanced geothermal. We had Fervo on the podcast, and interesting, they see geothermal being able to rival nuclear power today in terms, 20-ish% of, electrical demand furnished by geothermal, where today is probably sub 1%, I think.
Yeah, and it's all conventional legacy stuff today.
Yeah, and that's a lot of work from now to then. All right, I'm watching our time, so let's have a little bit of fun now, because I think one of the most fun things we do, but really looking at years of doing this, it's been one of the most interesting questions and the responses. In just a moment, I will hand you a magic wand, And with that magic wand, you can do anything you want to impact climate change, the conversation, policies, however you want to impact it. But it has to be for one thing in the next year. How would you use your magic wand?
Well, I think we talked about it on the show a bit, but I would use my magic wand to address the interconnection and permitting challenges around the world. Okay, those aren't just unique to the U.S. Europe is having a hell of a time building new stuff as well. I think that the costs for a lot of these technologies are at the point where if we were able to build them at scale and rapidly, we'd see a dramatic decarbonization of the power system. We'd see electricity costs come down, which then makes it a lot easier to do things like electrify your house, electrify certain processes in industry, makes EV economics pencil better. And I think it is the barrier in the US right now to rapid decarbonization is the inability to build particularly clean energy technologies at scale because of all of the interconnection and permitting challenges. It's a little different than the abundance theory that some of your listeners may know about. I think this is really targeted at is addressing some of these interconnection problems. But I think if you solve that here and you solve it in Europe and you solve it in other countries, we can just vastly accelerate the decarbonization of the electricity system. And as we know, the path to getting to net zero is heavily dependent on electrifying the rest of the economy. So it's kind of the piece that needs to fall into place before all the others can be realized.
Great use of your wand. You know, one of the things as I was studying up a little bit about you and your work, you really take a really strong worldwide view. I know just looking at a couple countries I was watching, China, Canada, India, Indonesia, Mexico, Saudi, United States, you really have a broad view. Anywhere that you're looking where they're really doing it right?
That is a great question.
They're really moving to, and let me help you define right. They're moving to a resilient and affordable energy system that's also clean and responsible for manufacturing and consumers.
Yeah. There's bits and pieces here and there. I wouldn't say any single country's got it totally figured out, but there are bits and pieces. I think when you go to countries that are succeeding in deploying electric vehicles, one of the things you see is just a proliferation of charging infrastructure. Park on the street, charge your car. Park in a parking garage, charge your car. In fact, in a lot of economies where this is really strong, whether because people tend to live in dense multifamily housing or for other reasons, you actually have the inverse of what you see in the US, which is most people don't charge their cars at home. They might go out and charge their car while they're shopping. And so countries, you know, I've seen it in parts of Europe. I just got back from Berlin and Brussels. And in Brussels, you walk around the street, you'll just see people have their cars plugged in charging while they're out shopping or if they're at work. China has invested heavily in EV charging infrastructure. And so I think, you know, that is core. You can't get people to buy EVs and to, you know, get away from what they know if they're not basically 100% confident that their car will be charged up when they need it. So that I've seen that in a few countries. I just got off a podcast this week with a gentleman who I think leads the American Nuclear Society. And he was talking about some of the Middle East investment in nuclear. And I was also just looking at some data for nuclear out of Korea. And what you're seeing with some of these sites is they have well-made conventional nuclear plants, but they're coming in at very competitive costs, right? So I think there's some lessons that can be learned about how we deploy nuclear in a cost-effective way, on time, on budget, from countries in the Middle East and from countries like Korea who are doing it quickly and at scale. And then You know, I think the world as a whole is kind of behind on decarbonizing manufacturing. There are some bright spots here and there. And there's a lot of work being done in Europe as well. Although increasingly we've seen some projects be canceled for low carbon steel, for example, or low carbon cement. So be curious to see how those play out a little bit. So, you know, I think you kind of have to look around and pull the threads on which countries are doing certain things well and try and understand why and what the lessons are. You know, there's some, for example, California in the U.S. is now integrating a really high share of renewables pretty effectively. And perhaps the ultimate irony is that Texas is now the state with the largest amount of renewables being installed. And so a question there is like, well, why is that happening? Well, it has to do in part with how well they've designed their energy market. You see a lot of battery storage coming because that battery storage can make a lot of money because it's getting those signals from the grid operator when it's needed and where it's needed, and it can deliver. So if you're looking for examples of where, you know, electricity grid operator practices are really well designed to address a future with a high degree of variable renewables, you could look at California and Texas, two very different markets, but both having some success with that. So a lot of times, a few years ago, we wrote this book called Designing Climate Solutions. And the first part of the book is kind of teeing up quantitatively, you know, what are we talking about? We need to reduce how our emissions separated across different parts of the economy. But the second part of the book was all about then how do you go about actually decarbonizing those sectors, manufacturing, buildings, the electricity sector, transportation, and so on. And we pulled examples from around the world of where we saw pretty effective policy doing that and how that policy was designed and what kind of results it were delivering. And so I think that's it's a little bit outdated, but there's still some interesting insights in there. I think the main thing is that there are different countries doing things really well. And the kind of ideal outcome is to figure out what you want to do. You know, I want to get more EVs on the road. I want to integrate renewables cost effectively. I want to figure out how to build nuclear on time and on budget and go see what those countries are doing. And there's a ton of policy and technology experts around the world who specialize in all those things. So there's a big community and a lot of lessons that can be learned and a lot of ongoing learning because we're still trying out a whole bunch of things. You know, to the earlier point, we haven't really figured out the policy mechanism to decarbonize industry, but there's a lot of interesting experiments going on across the world.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Our last tradition we love to do is plant a tree in honor of the time you've shared with us, your expertise. We like that forest to be a national forest, but we like you to choose. Is there a national forest that you would enjoy seeing a tree planted in your honor?
I love this question. It's so different from some of the other things on different podcasts. And I will admit, I went online and I said, what are all of the national forests? Because I'll bet I know a few of them, but certainly not most of them. And so where I landed on is the Angeles National Forest. I'm from Los Angeles. I'm heading out there tomorrow to go see my family for the holidays. And so my choice would be to put a tree out in California in the Angeles National Forest where, there's been years of drought and forest fires. And I can't think off the top of my head of a place that would be better to have one more tree to help out.
Well, you have just made our producer, Russ, very happy because there's nothing he likes better than planting a new tree in California and hopefully finding out an expense paid reason to go visit his beloved Southern California himself. So great choice. As we wrap up, anything you want to tell our listeners about something you're working on, maybe how to learn a little bit more about what's going on at Energy Innovation, anything you want us to know as we wrap up?
Sure. Yeah. So if you're curious to see more about what we're working on, we're online at energyinnovation.org. And I guess I'll share, I actually spend a lot of my time trying to assess the impacts of different policies, as you mentioned, around the world in different countries. And we really pride ourselves on making all of our tools available publicly. They're all free. They're all open source. So all the data's there. So if you want to go learn about what's going on in your state, or another country, You can go to energypolicy.solutions and go click on any of our models, and they all run in the web, and you can go figure out, you know, what a vehicle emissions look like, what's the power grid headed, and so on. So I encourage folks who might be interested to go to energypolicy.solutions and have a look.
Yeah, as I was preparing for this, I went to both those sites, and they're really worth going to. Lots of great articles, sometimes short length, sometimes a little bit more in depth. So a great use of people who are interested in it. And then the models are fascinating in that, as you say, they're interactive and you can work with them. Robbie, thank you so much for being with us today on Path to Zero. Really appreciated you being here and great insights. Thank you.
Thanks, Tucker. Hope you have a good holiday and a good new year as well.
Thanks for listening to Path to Zero. If you enjoyed the conversation, please subscribe and leave a review on your favorite podcast app or on YouTube. It really helps more people discover the show. You can also find this episode, past interviews, and additional insights on Substack at pathtozero.substack.com. Thanks again for spending time with us, and we'll see you next time on Path to Zero.